Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for September's Small Animal Practice webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for today, Professor of Feline Medicine, Danielle Gunn-Moore. Thank you, Danielle. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you, Sammy Joe. Actually, just move my mic. Thank you, Sammy Joe. Great to be here. I always love an opportunity to speak to you all. As always, huge thank you for organising everything. So, feline triaditis. I can remember when I first heard this phrase, and it was a long time ago now, and I remember thinking, inflammation of the Chinese mafia. What on earth has that got to do with me? And then eventually I worked out it was the inflammation of the three, and the three that we're talking about are inflammatory bowel disease, the biliary system, not the liver per se, it is the biliary system at least initially, and the pancreas. And I'm going to be a little bit indulgent if that's okay with you. Because the first case and the major case I'm going to talk about is actually my own cat. I have lost her since. I lost her 2 years ago. But having lived with her for so many, many years, I had her until she was 18. I was very, very lucky. I got to see so many different variations of feline triaditis. I really thought that she was the perfect cat to share with. Oh, I haven't put that on screen for you. There we go. So, here she is. This is my beautiful mini cat. So her name was Tia Ninnick, but Tia Ninnick is a bit of a mouthful, and so we called her Ninny for short. And she really was a bit of a ninny, probably one of the oldest Bengals that there was in the country then. I know, she doesn't look much like a Bengal. She was actually an F4, but obviously she was the runt of the pack. There she is again in this particular photo, trying to get herself poisoned with lilies. The only saving grace is actually she was nearly blind at this point, so she wouldn't have seen the lily above her, and so she ignored it anyway. So, oh yeah, she's named after Scottish malt whiskey, if I hadn't already said that. So I'm going to introduce you to her at the point where she is 4 years old. Indoor-only cat, living with one other cat, a fluffy boy called Cardu, also named after a malt whiskey. And when we lost him, then another fluffy boy, this time a Maine Coon, called Mortlach. You can see there's definitely a theme of good whiskey there. She had large bowel diarrhea as a kitten, lots of blood and mucus. To be honest, I'm pretty certain that that would have been Trichomonas fetus, but we didn't know that existed then. It really hadn't been discovered. And whether she would have had a sensitive gut anyway, or whether it was caused by the legacy of the Chytrix, I'm not sure. But certainly I see more than their fair share of Bengal cats presented to me with GI problems. So I do get the feeling that they do have delicate intestines. That said, of course, they are predisposed quite markedly to Chytrix as well. So, you know, if they've had kittenhood Chytrix, then that could leave the legacy. So six, one, half a dozen of the other, I guess. So she did recover from that, but always had episodes of mainly diarrhea. So it had started off as very much large bowel diarrhea, but she would get episodes of small bowel diarrhea as time went on. So the mucus and the blood had gone, and she would just have a lot of large volume, not necessarily with increased frequency with time. She did vomit occasionally as well, but that was much less of a picture. When she was four, she had had mild weight loss, and so her appetite was variable. On the days where she had diarrhea, then she didn't tend to want to eat very much. And at this point, I'm introducing you to her, that the diarrhea certainly had got more frequent. So what are our differentials for diarrhea? Well, you've got intestinal and extra-intestinal ones. The intestinal ones are certainly dietary related, are very important, and certainly if we were dealing with kittens, they would be my major ones, so indiscretion, intolerance. And you certainly do see hypersensitivity occasionally in adult cats. Infectious disease, I'm going to come back to, but certainly that's always important to remember, and particularly with younger cats. Interoception, we tend to see that, interestingly, in younger cats as a result of a lot of worms, or in older cats when they've got a lymphoma at the ileocecal-colic junction. So if you see this in an older cat, then just be a little bit anxious. Partial obstruction, that could be with foreign bodies or worms. Tend to be younger cat disease, but not always. Obviously, we do get partial obstruction with neoplasia as well. Inflammatory bowel disease obviously makes it a major group, and the most common is going to be your lymphoplasmacytic or plasmacytic lymphocytic, whichever way you wish to say that round. Eosinophilic and suppurative, thankfully, are much less common. Of the neoplasias, lymphoma is obviously your major one. We do see somatinocarcinoma, particularly actually in Siamese cats, there's my pointer, and mast cell neoplasia, again, more in Siamese cats, but we do see it in some other breeds occasionally. And then if we're looking at extra-intestinal, here we are talking about the polysystemic infections, so that's feline parvovirus, FIP, so two that you're going to see more in pedigree cats, toxoplasmosis that you're going to see more in cats that hunt, shoot, and fish. Salmonellosis, again, we're going to particularly see that related to hunting. Then various drugs and toxins, and I'm going to put antibiotics as a specific drug in there, because what we do see is kittens that have been given a lot of antibiotics when they're babies quite often end up having a chronically damaged bowel, whether it is because whatever the primary infection was that they had damaged the bowel, or whether it's because of the dysbiosis that results from injudicious use of antibiotics. It's hard to say, but certainly we need to worry about overuse of antibiotics. And then we need to think of pancreas and liver, definitely, and occasionally you'll see diarrhea in severe kidney cases, but you should have some pretty obvious signs that you've got kidney disease as well. And of the infectious causes, there's Ninny as a kitten. Wasn't she adorable? Look at that. Gorgeous girl. Oh, and you can see we've got her as a shadow on the slides as well. I know, I was a bit indulgent, but I hoped you'd forgive me. When we are talking about particular infections, we have got a whole load of bacteria here. The most important ones for causing diarrhea, acute salmonellosis, definitely, but that's going to be a sick cat. And then Campylobacter, well, there's an interesting study that actually showed that cats with Campylobacter were actually less likely to have diarrhea than those that did. It was a big epidemiological study. I love that study. But certainly Campylobacter can cause GI problems, certainly in some cats. The biggest problem is with so many of these infections, whether it's Campylobacter, Clostridium perfringens, or difficulty, E. coli, Cryptosporidium, Giardia, Tritrix, etc. All of them can be anything from asymptomatic carriage to severe diarrhea. And so when you actually find them in a cat's fecal sample, how do you know that they are the cause of the problem? That is always a major thing to factor in. Just because you found it doesn't mean it's actually the cause of the problem. Just to pick a few other comments, Helicobacter, obviously, that's gastric, so that would cause really vomiting rather than diarrhea. Toxoplasmosis rarely causes diarrhea. That's going to be much more of a systemic disease. So Tritrix is really much more of a baby cat problem, and I do think she did have that. Coccidia, again, that's usually a baby cat problem, as is GI parasites. Yes, you'll find tapeworms, occasionally roundworms, in adult cats, but they rarely cause any clinical signs at all. Acute FELV or FIV certainly can cause enteric problems, but very rare. And obviously FIP, coronavirus can cause GI problems alone, but also can result in FIP, which can have GI problems. Parvovirus is an interesting one. We are finding it more and more frequently because of the multiplex PCR panels. Well, we're finding parvovirus. That could either be feline pyelocopenia virus or canine parvovirus. The test picks up both. But it really doesn't fit that it is the cause of that much disease. Unfortunately, panels are very sensitive. So even if the cat is just carrying it in their bowel, just they picked it up off their paws and, you know, and cleaned themselves, then unfortunately you will get it in their feces. But really, cats with panleukopenia should be really quite sick. So in kittens, I would say certainly in Britain, and generally then it would be Trichomonas, Toxocara, and I still call it Cytospora. It's called Cytospora. I can't even say it. I wish people wouldn't keep changing the names of things. And parvovirus would be the major players. In adults, I would say Tritrix, because we still do see it in adults, particularly if they're first exposed to it as adults. Giardia, potentially Campi, Clostridium, and Salmonella species would be the most important infectious causes of diarrhea. But I did want to share a study with you, because I think it really underlines the importance of thinking about the tests we do, and that we should think about what the results might mean to us before we actually run the test. So this was using the feline IDEX panel. That's a couple of years ago now, although we published it in 2014. It's amazing how the time flies. And we had over 1,000 diarrheic samples from pussycats. And what you can see, so some of the infections were incredibly common. So at about 50 to 60%, we had coronavirus. Now, clearly all those cats aren't dying from FIP. This is asymptomatic carriage in the vast majority of these cats. And Clostridium perfringens, and this was actually looking for the enterotoxigenic gene. Clearly, just because the gene's there doesn't mean it's the bacteria actively making the toxin, but it shows you how commonly you will find these bacteria in the bacterium virus, in this case, in these cats. Then sitting at about the 20 to 25% prevalence mark, we have got the parvoviruses, we've got Giardia, we've got Trichomonas, and we've got Cryptosporidium species. The only two that were less than 1%, well, 1% or less, was Toxoplasma gondii, which of course this is the cats first shedding it when they've first been hunting. And then Salmonella. Probably these cats, most of these, were actually sick with Salmonella. Not to say that you can't carry Salmonella asymptomatically, you can, but it seems to be much less less common than most of these other infections. And I think it is interesting to note another point from this study. Well, I'm not sure what happened just there. This is the number of pathogens. So each cat, what did they carry? And you can see that the most common was to carry at least two potential pathogens. But some of these greedy cats were carrying eight, i.e. all eight pathogens, which really is going some, isn't it? And you can see 20% are carrying three. So multiple carriage is common. Now, clearly, that, to reiterate, just because a pathogen is there doesn't mean it's actually causing disease. What we certainly know is that asymptomatic carriage is much more common in young cats and kittens. Unfortunately, so is disease. So the way I kind of look at it is, if you find these infections in a young cat, they may or may not be the cause, but they are more likely to cause disease in this group. But if you get an older cat where you find a significant burden of one of these potential pathogens, then I do get more focused on it, simply because it's less common for them to carry them. So it's more likely to be real. So where you particularly see bacteria, viruses, other infectious agents, young cats, particularly if group housed, particularly if stressed, so rescues or strays, particularly if they're fed raw meat, because accessing raw meat that hasn't got concurrent infections, particularly Salmonella, Campylobacter, and actually, what's the word, the neurological one? Oh, I'll remember later, don't worry. That they've got GI disease, particularly inflammatory bowel disease, because the gut can't clear the infections so well. So Listeria is the one I was trying to remember. So all of these cats are more likely to have infections. But look at some of these numbers. These are prevalence studies from normal cats. Some of these were, I should say, normal to diarrheic cats. Campylobacter, say up to 60% we saw in our study. You do see higher prevalences when you're looking at PCR studies because they are so much more sensitive. And of course, they're also picking up dead pathogens. It doesn't tell you whether it's live or dead. It just tells you the DNA is there. Salmonella up to 18% in one study. This was a study of kittens in a rescue center. Giardia, so 11% in this study, 20% in our study. Cryptosporidium, you can see, again, very variable. Clostridium, very variable. And Clostridium perfringens, as we saw, 60%, and that's even with the enterotoxic gene. But when you're actually looking at cytopathology, so this means the gene is actively being produced, so this is definitely with the toxin, this is down to about 2%. So what do those numbers mean? Well, it means you have to be careful with interpretation. You know, we can't just, you know, send off the poop for that multiplex PCR and go, oh, yeah, this is the result, it's come back, this is the cause of the problem, let's treat, the cat will be better, because that's not necessarily going to be the case. So, last thought, vomiting, sorry, diarrhea, but then remember little Ninny was vomiting too, so infectious agents, we're going to add in Helicobacter. I don't think we'd say anything more about those. Dietary, I think, played a significant role with Ninny, because certainly the time she stole the guacamole was quite interesting. That was the litter box from hell. Oh, you really didn't want to go there. And certainly when she stole other foods, sometimes it really wasn't pretty. And her diet could always be settled by giving her cooked chicken. That always seemed to be the best way to settle her gut, which does feed into the concept that diet was a significant player. Inflammatory bowel disease has to be considered. And then, yeah, we've mentioned all these other guys. So how do we set about diagnostics with a cat like Ninny? Well, you might want to start with some baseline tests. Hematology, serum biochemistry with T4, particularly in an older cat. Certainly, if you've got a sick cat, then you might want to go to those, particularly if you're thinking that, for example, FIP might be involved, then that's going to be important to look for those biochemical changes, so high globulins, low albumins, etc. Serology, you might want to consider FELV, FIV, coronavirus, for what it's worth, toxoplasmosis if you're suspecting that, certainly if you've got retinal changes. Fecal investigations, certainly culture for pathogenic bacteria, you certainly might want to consider, particularly if it's more of a chronic and certainly a severe case. And then examination of feces. We'll come back to those. And it's obviously important that we know how to do them correctly, and we need to know what the lab is actually doing, whether they're being done correctly. But most important, we have to tailor to the patient. If this, so Ninny as she was at this point, do we need to do a whole load of investigations? You know, should we just try a diet change? Whereas if she was, you know, fevery, etc., then, you know, certainly you'd want to be going ahead straight away with more investigation. So your non-invasive screening tests, so abdominal radiography can be helpful occasionally if there's a foreign body, partial obstruction, something like that. Abdominal ultrasound, though, is far, far more useful. And that's where I'd put my money straight away if I was going to go there. I'll hold back on serum B12 folate, PLI, TLI, for the chronic cases, because these rarely change acutely. Therapeutic trials, though, I jump in with these pretty quickly. Certainly, if I'm not comfortable that the worming has been good, I'm going to do that. Despite the fact, as you just heard me say, I really don't believe that worms cause clinical disease in adult cats. Yeah, but I'd also feel pretty stupid to end up doing endoscopy to find a big worm. That's, you know, that's a really inefficient and very expensive way of worming a cat. Probiotics I do use, and we're going to come back to those as well. And diet, I'm going to say a few more words in a second. I don't jump in with an antibiotic trial until significantly later on, and I really try not to, and it's going to be a chronic case that I'm going to consider. And then it would be something like Tylan or metronidazole maybe. We'll come back to that. And again, corticosteroids, I don't do a trial with those unless it's a chronic case that's failed diet trials, failed probiotics, failed worming, maybe failed a Tylosin challenge, and the owners really don't want to go for further investigation by way of endoscopy. So I'm going to do a diet trial in all except really seriously ill cats, and my reasoning for that is that different studies will give you between 30 and 50% of cases that appear to be a type of inflammatory bowel disease will respond to the diet change. So given that about 50% are going to respond to a diet change alone, yeah, you're going to do that before you do anything else. And yeah, I really want to get biopsies before I would go to corticosteroids. So what about Ninny then? Well, she's slim, slightly thickened intestines. They were pretty prominent. I did do bloods, slightly high on the newt, slightly low on the lymphs, nothing exciting. ALT was up a splotch, and AP was up a splotch too. So looking like, so that's the liver parenchyma, and this is the biliary tract. So something going on there. No pathogens in her poop. She was a house cat, and we didn't feed her raw food, but she fed herself raw food every now and again, because really they were stupid mice, but we used to have mice that would break into the flat, which, you know, they ask what they get when they break into a house with two cats, don't they? So provisional diagnosis. Well, I was thinking dietary intolerance, hypersensitivity was my top one, probably being part of the inflammatory bowel disease complex. And then we've got those raised liver enzymes, so I'm thinking the cholangitis may be part of it, potentially pancreatitis, although I haven't done any bloods or anything for that yet. So investigations at this point, I would be thinking a trial, definitely for diet. I would be thinking an abdo scan, and I would be wanting to say, okay, this has gone on a while, let's be looking at B12 folate, PLI, TLI, let's find out what they're doing. What did I do? Well, you know what vets are like. You know, I kind of went, oh, do I really want to do that? Well, that will stress her out. So I thought I could repeat the worming, couldn't I? That's pretty benign. I could maybe try some probiotics. And I thought, okay, at least I'm going to do a diet trial. So I did start with probiotics. We were looking at them quite a lot at that point. I'm sure you all know what probiotics are. They're live bacteria that repopulate the gut, supposedly only transiently, but sometimes they last a little bit longer. And they produce lactic acid. So these are the classic three. There are many different types available. Most of the ones for animals have so far to date been Enterococcus vicarum. That's what you're going to find in Procoalin, Symbiotic, the same company, and in Fortiflora. There are two available now, the Sivoy and the SL3/. These actually are seven bacteria combinations. Good data looking in dogs, but nothing in cats so far. And sometimes, for example, like the Symbiotic, they've got prebiotics added as well, like fructooligosaccharides. These are supposed to be particularly good at helping large bowel function. There are some studies. Interestingly, the studies have tended to show more positive effects in cats and dogs, which I think is interesting. Most of the work has been done on Fortiflora. So this is Enterococcus vicarum. I like this study. So decent numbers, over 200 cats. It was a rescue colony, double-blown, placebo-controlled, and over a four-week course of cats that had diarrhea that lasted 2 days or more. Those on the Fortiflora, there was only 7%, well, as in the non-Fortiflora group, it was 21%. So a significant difference. They will also reduce the number of Clostridium perfringens in cat feces, which is good. So what about dietary trials? To be honest, I started Ninny with a probiotic. She was possibly a little better on it, but I wasn't convinced. So I switched pretty quickly to doing a dietary trial. Different people do different things here. Depends who you speak to. Some people do funky things with sacrificial proteins. Weird. I will go with a single protein source. I don't go with a novel protein source. I go with a single protein source. I don't see any need for carbohydrates when we're talking about cats. Some people would go with gluten-free. obviously, if that makes sense. Lactose-free makes pretty good sense too. My two ways of doing it have tended to be either using the protein hydrolysates, so I certainly use a lot of Purina HA. But these diets, the hydrolyzed diets, have become more palatable now, so that's pretty good. Or if owners don't want to do that, if they want to home cook, then I would say cooked chicken, boiled water. I stress the boiled water as a way of saying, you know, nothing else must pass this cat's lips, because otherwise you find that all the treats still get given and they're not counted in. So different studies have looked at using novel proteins, etc., and the data doesn't vary that much. It's always between 30 and 50% of the cats get better. So it kind of pays your money and takes your choice. What I tend to do, an initial phase, I'm going to do either cooked or hydrolysate. I've said 2 to 4 weeks, but to be honest, you know if it's going to work within a week, possibly two. And what I always say to the owners is, give me 1 week of religiously just feeding this diet and boiled water. If there is no change at all, then we will try a different diet. So if we were going for home cook, then let's go for a hydrolysate. Or if it was hydrolysate, then let's go for different hydrolysate. If there's partial improvement over a week, then I go, okay, now let's keep this up for another week and let's see how good we can get it. And certainly if you've had a cat that's had diarrhea for a long time, vomiting for a long time, by the time the owner has had 2 weeks with no vomit or poop to clean up, they're quite happy to stay on the diet. It's actually getting them to switch back to a more balanced diet if they're on a home cook is the hard thing. So really 2 weeks is what you need here. And then ultimately, I do try to get them onto the maintenance diet, which would be a commercial hypoallergenic, easily metabolized. So we're looking for a single meat protein source is my preference. I want it to be easily digestible. Say, I don't feel the need for a great deal of carbohydrates. Cat don't need carbs. Gluten-free, lactose-free, as a kind of a recap. With Ninny, I went for the boiled chicken because she just loves chicken, or loved chicken. And in 2 weeks, she was significantly better by 7 days. So we went on to a chicken-only commercial diet. So a diet that was based on mainly chicken as the protein source. And she's good for 2 years, which is great. She then relapsed. Giardia. And you're going to go, but she doesn't go outside. No, but she could have always had the Giardia there and there's just been a flare-up for another reason. Or was there a mouse with Giardia? Maybe there was a mouse with Giardia that was stupid enough to come in and get you. So she's now 6 years old and we've got Giardia. So we put her back onto her chicken and boiled water and we treated her with fenbendazole. That was great. There was a good, really good improvement there. Now, the data for use of fenbendazole for the treatment of Giardia in cats actually is not that great. And I do find that often it's not enough. So I'll try fenbendazole first because it's the least potentially toxic. If that's not enough or it doesn't work, if you see what I mean, then I will switch to metronidazole. But I don't jump in with metronidazole first because there are more potential side effects with metronidazole. But she did good. So I went back to the way we were, which was great. And then she was good for about a year. So she's 7 now. And then we've got a progressive deterioration. So bloods, liver values are up even more, and her phosphate's falling now. The phosphate falling tells me that she's really not absorbing well. So at this point, I'm going to do some more work. And I'm going to be thinking about triaditis. The reason triaditis is such a player is because in cats, you know, I think they're perfect. Perfect in almost every way. There's only one little bit of them that isn't perfect. And that is here. In their evolution to become obligate meat eaters, they've got rid of what they don't need. It's evolved out of them. Only 20% of cats still have an accessory pancreatic duct. And if they do have it, it's tiny and pretty useless, which means they're always dealing with the common bile duct coming in with the pancreatic duct at the sphincter of Oddi into the duodenum. The problem with that is if you get any inflammation at the sphincter of Oddi, then that's going to close off and you risk getting bile backing up into the biliary system, which is bad, but it can also, if you're really unlucky, get it into the pancreas. And the digestive enzymes are going to back up into the pancreas, triggering pancreatitis. And again, if you're really unlucky, get into the biliary system. But the other thing that is as in the evolution of cats is their bowel is much shorter than a weight-for-weight dog. And not only is it much shorter, you've got really high bacterial numbers in the upper small bowel, which means if something makes you vomit, and let's be honest, it's pretty easy to make a cat vomit, then you risk bacteria from the small bowel being flushed into the biliary system and into the pancreas, triggering a suppurative triaditis. If this goes on chronically, then you can get a lymphocytic triaditis. And there's a specific little part of the immune system is gamma delta T cells, and they circulate through these areas. And so if one area is inflamed, it does seem to lead to beside it getting inflamed. So that is why we see pancreatitis, cholangitis, and IBD so often in cats. And the associated syndromes then, so inflammatory bowel disease, the plasmacytic lymphocytic unfortunately has a pretty high propensity with time to mutate and become alimentary lymphoma. If you're lucky, that will be a switch to small cell lymphoma. Prognosis isn't too bad, but it can also switch to large cell lymphoma when the prognosis is pretty horrid. The eosinophilic IBD can end up with this eosinophilic sclerosing fibroplasia, which is a horrible condition. And I hate these diseases. Eosinophilic IBD, I would much rather treat small cell lymphoma than I would eosinophilic IBD. Thankfully, suppurative IBD is pretty rare, but it does occur. Cholangitis can spread and take over more of the liver, so you can end up with a cholangiohepatitis. And the pancreatitis with time can result in chronic pancreatitis, ultimately resulting in exocrine pancreatic insufficiency and or diabetes mellitus, which is a very unlucky cat. So the first question then is, how do we diagnose pancreatitis? If you are thinking that you're going to see vomiting, diarrhea and abdominal pain, as you would see in the dog, or for that matter, the human, then no, you're going to miss it. Because the clinical signs in the cat are anorexia, depression, and lethargy. I know, no use whatsoever. And that's important because it means it is a much more subtle disease in clinical presentation in the cat. You will see vomiting, diarrhea, etc., but in less than maybe 30%. And abdominal pain is very dependent on just how good you are at assessing cats, which isn't always that easy. Routine bloods aren't going to be very helpful. In very severe cases, you may see hypocalcemia. That is where you've got peripancreatic fat necrosis. You know, if you see an ultrasound or a radiograph where it's very bright around the pancreas, that is because you've got inflammation affecting the fat. That's a poor prognostic sign. Routine amylase and lipase is no use at all. And then let's have a look at the role of these other diagnostics. I guess I should point out to what's this little cat here doing? If you think that's the praying position because of pain, nope. That cat's just stretching. I'm sure most of you realize that. And this is severe vasculitis. And we're going to come back to that because unfortunately that is quite typical in cats with pancreatitis. Ultrasonography certainly can be useful, more useful than radiography, to be perfectly honest. Radiography is rarely helpful other than in acute pancreatitis. But ultrasonography definitely can be useful. Yes, you may see a swollen, heterogeneous pancreas, as you can see here, particularly with a very dilated pancreatic duct, although be careful, that does dilate slowly with time and age. Peripancreatic fat necrosis, as I've already mentioned, you can see that in this image at the bottom, where you've got very bright white going around. You may see ileus, so the duodenum appears distended. And then where you've got some degree of extrahepatic biliary obstruction, you may see a distended gallbladder, a very convoluted common bile duct. You may see sludge in the gallbladder. You may see very bright white edge to the gallbladder, which is an indication of inflammation. We had one recently where we had gas-producing bacteria in the gallbladder, and we could see lots of speckles of air in there, which was certainly quite scary. And if the cat hasn't been eating for a few days, then you may see a large homogeneous bright white liver. That means you've got hepatic lipidosis, or it can be more mottled when you've got inflammation and infection going on in there. These blood tests can be useful. So an increased feline pancreatic lipase immunoreactivity, or increased feline trypsin-like immunoreactivity, so PLI or TLI, they go up with pancreatic inflammation. The problem with the TLI, which is the first one that we had on the books, is, as you can see below, it doesn't stay up for very long. So what you see is that you see these rapid spikes. Let me just bring up a pointer. There we go. What you see are these rapid spikes, which then fall back down. So it's not a very accurate way of diagnosing inflammation of the pancreas. The TLI now tends to be used to detect the drop-off in pancreatic mass, as we see here, in which case we've got exocrine pancreatic insufficiency. But it is worth remembering, it will go up each time the pancreas is inflamed. So actually, if you note what's happening here, that if you take this cat's blood when there's actually an episode of pancreatitis, you will miss the EPI. It's only when you go back into the resting state that you actually detect EPI. Whereas when we're looking at the PLI, this goes up higher and stays up longer. So I hope that convinces you that that's therefore a better way of assessing pancreatic inflammation. As you can see, goes up higher, stays up longer. A reduction in B12, particularly in the cat, can be very, very helpful. That is because in the cat, the extrinsic factor is only made in cat's pancreases. None comes from the stomach, which it does in dogs and people. So the B12 goes down quickly in cats if there's any reason for a lack of absorption or increased diuresis, so with chronic kidney disease. So we find this dropping fast if there is disease in the pancreas or terminal ileum, and cats can't store it either. So we really do see critically low B12 levels, to the point where they're unmeasurable. And interestingly, we had a cat present recently to our neurology department for seizuring. She also had increased appetite and had weight loss. And it turned out that she had got EPI. But the first sign she showed was actually of seizures related to B12 deficiency, because the owner simply hadn't noticed the more obvious GI signs that you'd expect to be obvious, but actually weren't particularly prominent in her. And then a low folate tends to be disease in the small intestine. So I do use these tests, particularly B12. Yes, you could biopsy the pancreas. The problem is, where do you biopsy? If you only biopsy the point of one of the arms, well, you know what? It's probably in the body of the pancreas. And you don't want to go near the body of the pancreas because, you know what, that's where all the ducts are. So we don't tend to biopsy so frequently. And certainly there are papers that show that while it can be a gold standard, it only is if you take multiples and multiples of biopsies, by which time, yeah, you've probably caused pancreatitis, which is, as the residents would say, suboptimal. So what about little mini cat then? Well, we have got the special assays, so B12 and folate are down. So I'm thinking, okay, that could all be gut. Normal TLI, but she's got a raised PLI. So yeah, she does have pancreatitis. So that fits with chronic GI and chronic pancreatitis. And her abdominal ultrasound is certainly consistent with that. We've got an ugly looking pancreatitis that with all of the things you'd expect, and her intestines don't look happy. We've got thickening of them, a very obvious muscularis layer, although that said, you can see that in normal cats or cats with IBD or cats with small cell lymphoma. Doesn't help very much, does it? Oh, and I should have said, yeah, her liver was looking a little bit unhappy too. Certainly everything there is consistent with a triaditis cat. To make a diagnosis of IBD, you really do need you need biopsies, whether they are mucosal, which obviously the endoscopically gained ones, you're not going to get full thickness. So you're also only going to be, you're not going to be able to look right down into the terminal ileum unless you get that cat very well cleaned out so you can go per rectum and into the ileum, which obviously we can do that too. It just, the preparation for the cat isn't always the easiest. Always make sure your pathologists are commenting on the Helicobacter number and whether there's any associated inflammation. That's pretty obvious. And make notes of any gross changes that might you might note while you're doing either the endoscopy or the full thickness biopsies. I really think it's important to try and get material for culture as well. If the gallbladder isn't looking too ugly, then aspirating from the gallbladder, either percutaneously or at laparoscopy or laparotomy, then that is great. But you will find cases like the case recently we had with the gas in the gallbladder. The images went, no way, not sticking a needle in that. It's going to fall apart completely. So what we do then is we aspirate the liver. And then we squirt the cells that we aspirated from the liver onto, you know, a cotton tip swab, and then we culture that. It isn't as accurate as culturing bile to find out what bacteria in the biliary system, but it certainly can be helpful. So I do recommend that if you're doing an exblab, say bile, or if you're too worried about bile, then take a little bit of liver or mesenteric lymph node and culture from that. If you can, it's great because it gives you a better idea of what bacteria you're actually dealing with. You've then got the question, okay, how do I get a diagnosis? Actually taking liver biopsies. So we've taken endoscopic biopsies or gut. We can take fine needle aspirates from the bile for culture, even for culture from the liver. But then we really want to know what pathology is in the liver. So we can do fine needle aspirates. They are good for diagnosing lymphoma or hepatic lipidosis, although you don't know what the hepatic lipidosis is secondary to, or amyloidosis, if you ask for the special stains for that. But really, they're not very good for diagnosing infection. Other than if the pathologist, cytopathologist does comment, oh, there's a lot of neutrophils here, which certainly can be helpful. So then it comes, do you take wedge biopsies, or do you take ultrasound-guided tube cuts? It will be case-to-case representative, okay? You have to, if you're going to do XBLAP anyway, then you're there. Take a piece of liver. It'd be crazy not to. But it does depend on the particular case. What I do want to flag up is that an awful lot of cats and dogs with significant liver disease have got significant clotting time problems. So always check these before doing any liver FNAs, particularly before taking true cuts or wedges. What did we do with little mini cat? Well, I did upper GI endoscopy. I'm an endoscopist after all. We did do true cuts of her liver. Her clottings were a little bit prolonged, but nothing too scary, and we aspirated her bile. So I was happy that we'd got a good look round, and she'd got obvious inflammation in her gastric wall and in small intestines on endoscopy, and this was confirmed on histopath. She's got lymphocytic plasmacytic IBD and also lymphocytic in her liver. So I don't know for sure what's happening in her pancreas, but given the fact that we know that she's her FPLI is up and her B12 is down, I think we can pretty well guess. She's got lymphocytes in her pancreas as well, so she has got a lymphocytic plasmacytic triaditis. She read the textbook. So what's the pathogenesis of these diseases? Well, yeah, there's a whole lecture on that, and it wouldn't be by me. So it's multifactorial. We're really not sure. Genetics certainly plays a role. Exposure to particular infections, exposure to different foods, all sorts of things can play a role. So you've got altered sensitivity to the different antigens that are in the bowel, in the pancreas, in the liver. Certainly, I think genetics does play a role. Certain breeds, Abyssinians seem to have a big play, and Bengals have already mentioned those. So what about the treatment then? Well, if you can find out what the antigenic stimulant is, then take it away. That's kind of obvious, isn't it? Typically, it's going to be diet. Remember, that's going to sort out between 30 and 50% of your cases. Do that first. Then you might need to consider corticosteroids and or antibiotics. And the antibiotics that we're talking about here are metronidazole and tylosin. Do assess it case by case. For example, you're definitely going to be worried about high doses of corticosteroids if you're dealing with a Burmese cat, particularly a young one, because of their risk of diabetes later on. So you're going to be thinking, oh, maybe I don't want to go with corticosteroids. Maybe I would want to maybe use clorambucil as much, much sooner and much lower dose of corticosteroids or no corticosteroids. And any relapses warrant really critical assessment. If you've had a cat that's stable and has now deteriorated, think about, has something changed in the diet? Go back to do your dietary exclusion again. Could an infection have come in over the top? Because it does happen. So these guys are at risk of getting infections. That comes right back to the beginning of this talk. Or could a lymphocytic IBD have mutated into a lymphoma? They are your three major thoughts when these cats deteriorate. So diet, we've really talked that through already. So I don't think I need to say much more there. Immunosuppression, say corticosteroids, would be our first line. And I get in there with clorambucil pretty quickly because I find clorambucil is so well tolerated. That would be 2 milligrams per cat once to twice a week. And that works very, very well, often enabling you to really pull the steroid dose down, sometimes even to not need it at all. Some people like budesonide. I tried it a few times, and I'm not convinced of its efficacy, and it's certainly no safer than corticosteroids. And then we've got metronidazole and tylosin. They're not really being used truly as antibiotics. Possibly they reduce secondary bacterial overgrowth, whatever that condition is, and they may have an immunomodulatory effect, whatever that is. My preference is tylosin, although it's not the easiest drug to use. Please contact the reformulation labs, things like Nova Labs and Bova Labs, potentially Summit, because some of them they recapsulate tylosin for you, and that will make that easier. I prefer tylosin, as we know metronidazole is actually carcinogenic, so I don't want to be giving a long course of metronidazole to these cats. If I'm using it as a short course to treat Giardia, that's okay, but I'm certainly not going to go in with a long course of it. I hope that makes sense. She's on an enteric diet at this point, so she's on preds. She was about 5 kilos, just under, so she was on a mg per kg per day initially, and then we tapered that to every other day. Well, I went down to 2.5 and then to every other day. So a 5 milligram initially, down to 2.5 total. She stayed on her B12 initially every week and then up to every 3 weeks, and she was on folate for a while as well. The easiest way to supplement that is in this Lexpec solution. For her liver disease and potentially to help pancreatitis, because it is an antioxidant, then you're going to use SAMI. And we don't really have a treatment for chronic pancreatitis, potentially some kind of antacid like omeprazole or famotidine, potentially meropenem if she's sore. We really don't know the best way to go with treatment certainly for chronic pancreatitis yet. How did she do? Well, she did good. Got her to 14. And over the last 7 years, this has been 7 years, she's crawling, bumbling along. She has had slow progression of her vomiting and diarrhea. She's stayed on her pred. I could never get her lower than 2.5 milligrams per cat every other day. And to be honest, I did have to increase that up every now and again. Being a terrible vet and a bad owner, I didn't stay as good as I should have done with her B12. And when she was nauseous, I did used to give her famotidine. She developed progressive retinal atrophy and went blind. She developed bad arthritis, as you can see in this picture. She doesn't want to sit up for a blood draw. And at this point, she really had got quite skinny. So I decided, right, let's do some more investigations, because I was worried she really had lost weight. So we did abdominal scan. There was a mass in her pancreas. Her bowels looked worse than ever. Did endoscopy to start with. I was really hoping that I could get the answer with endoscopy. I didn't want to go to XFAP. The endoscopy suggested a small cell lymphoma of her gut, but I really needed to know what was happening in her pancreas. So I did an XPLAP as well. Well, that's a fib. My surgeons did the XPLAP. So lymphocytic cholangitis in her liver, gastric, small intestinal, and pancreatic small cell lymphoma. I must admit, I was pretty depressed at this point, but I thought about it and thought, you know what? There is more and more data that small cell lymphoma is not a death sentence. So you don't use a COP or a CHOP protocol. That's a good way to kill these guys. You simply increase the dose of prednisolone they're on. So in this case, I went up to 10 mgs of pred, back up to 10 mgs of pred right at the top per day. So that's just over 2 mgs per kg for her body weight at this point, a little bit over that. And clorambucil, which was on 2 milligrams total twice a week. How did she do? Twice a week initially, and then she got a bit nauseous on it, and I brought that down to once a week. Occasional B12, occasional famotidine. I got a good response. She's 14 years old. That's not bad, is it? A year later, this is weird, she got a UTI, an E. coli UTI, and at this point, bladder lymphoma. This was FNA'd and everything, bladder lymphoma. And I thought, what? Well, we're going to treat with antibiotics anyway, because she's miserable. She's got a UTI, and I needed to know whether I could get her UTI under control. We switched to prednisolone and CCNU at that point. She developed diabetes. She had 4 episodes of heart failure, became intolerant to oral medication. Now, at this point, my back went. So I was out of it. On high doses of fentanyl and everything. So my poor husband was left to cope. So he did the best he could. Do you know what he did? Well, he kind of switched to what I could manage. He could put needles in my hands or syringes in my hands, say he inject the cat. So poor little Ninny, you can see her there in the corner. She got her B12 once every 2 weeks, and she got Dexafor every 2 weeks with occasional meropenem if she felt nauseous. How did she do? She did another 3 years. Really good quality life. We were really happy with her. So there's a moral there. Be careful about escalating oncology drugs. They can, you know, we very nearly lost her. It was only my lack of my incapacitation that meant we had to back off. At that point, unfortunately, she developed a squamous cell carcinoma in her jaw. You can just about see it on that side of her mouth, which just destroyed her in just under a month. So I did lose her at 18 years old, but she had had a dodgy bowel her entire life. I think almost certainly she had trichomonas as a baby. She then had food responsive IBD. It then became steroid responsive IBD, eventually mutated over to small cell lymphoma of the IBD, well, and the pancreas, and the liver. So I'm hoping she's a case that really teaches you these cases can be okay. You need to have an owner who's at least vaguely compliant, although as you can see from my case, not necessarily terribly competent. And now I just want to finish off with another little cat for you. Much shorter case. This is Casper. He came to see us when he was 18 months old. Kerry Simpson and myself saw him. He had a 2-week history of watery green, diarrhea, and vomiting. Anorexic, collapse. This is a very sick boy. Okay, so this is a much shorter case in time and presentation. His heart rate, a little on the low side for a stressed cat, but no murmurs or arrhythmias. He was severely dehydrated and hypothermic, and we all know that is a really bad way to come in. We did not have a great hope that we were going to get him through, particularly if I tell you his respiratory rate was 60 with a marked expiratory effort, with a real grunt as he breathed out. I was very worried about that. Remember that, expiratory effort. He had marked bruising after venipuncture. These are not incompetent blood samples, all right? This was the minute you put your needle into his veins, they just oozed blood all over the place. Not nice at all. And on abdominal palpation, very fluidy intestines, generalized mild lymphadenopathy, but you could feel them, and discomfort. Not screaming agony, but discomfort. So your DDX for diarrhea, let's think about those. We talked about those a lot at the start, but this is severe diarrhea. So campy, unlikely salmonella, possibly, Clostridium, possibly, and a really nasty E. coli, potentially. Giardia, yeah, Tritrix is not a Tritrix. This is a small bowel case, and Tritrix is very unusual to do that. Systemic toxo, yeah, it could be that. Severe FELV or FIV, we can't rule them out. FIP, well, that causes vasculitis, but not an acute vasculitis like we've got here. Diet doesn't seem likely. Inflammatory bowel disease, not likely. A really nasty neoplasia, but it would need to be a lymphangiosarcoma or something horrible. Pancreatitis is definitely on my list. Vomiting, remember he's doing both, and they're green and they're nasty. I'm thinking, yep, salmonella, potentially E. coli. And as you look down, we're going to be pulling out the same ones. Salmonella, toxo, FELV, FIV. Potentially some kind of toxin. Yep, it could be a GI toxin even. You know, dogs, when they swim in the sea and get blue-green algae, if he was swimming in the sea, that would be something to consider, wouldn't it? Thankfully, he didn't. And what about this severe bruising? Well, is he in DIC? And you've definitely got to consider that. What about really increased vascular fragility? Yep, we need to check his clotting times. And then is it that he hasn't got platelets or that he's got them, but they're not very functional? This is actually another case of, this is a case of severe pancreatitis. This was a simple blood draw, and the little cat deteriorated so much overnight that we had to put him to sleep. You can see he's very nauseous as well. And you can see the massive bruising caused by a simple blood draw. So what else did we find? Well, pretty early on, we always take systemic blood pressure. And his was 90. It should be 120 to 180. And we know from a study we did years ago, any cat coming into our ICU with a blood pressure less than kind of 120, but definitely less than 100, the prognosis is they're not good. You can get some of them through, but it's going to be much tougher for the cat, and it's going to be much more expensive. So if there is a lack of finance, that is definitely something to think about. Blood pressure of 90, that is not pretty. We did his urine was unremarkable. We did hematology, biochemistry. We looked at all these things. What sort of results did we get? And of course, this was a Thursday, so we didn't get some of the results until the following week. Okay, what have we got here? Slightly low white cell count. Well, not very exciting. But remember, he is dehydrated, so it's probably a bit worse. It's red cell count. His white cell count is up, which seems to be neutrophils, and there is a left shift, some monocytes as well. So definitely inflammation, infection going on. Platelet count, it's not fabulous, but it's not low. Obviously, there could still be a thrombocytopathia, but it's not thrombocytopenia. If we look at our biochem, ALT is up a bit, but not very remarkable. Creatinine and urea further down, they're both up a bit. And yeah, his specific gravity was like 1035, 1040, so yeah, just fitted with dehydration really more than anything else. His glucose is low. That's a bit odd for a cat that's really stressed. Potassium's a bit low. Well, that's not surprising. His gut's not great. And his albumin's really pretty low. I think what's interesting is that his phosphate was normal, but maybe that reflects that this is such an acute problem for him. FELV, FLV were negative. And then we got the clotting times on the Thursday, and you can see they're not fabulous. They're all a bit long, certainly with all the horrible leaky blood vessels. Combine that and an APTT of 45, and I'm very reticent to make large holes in this cat. Fibrinogen is up, indicating he's very inflammatory. TikTok, so we didn't get back till the following week. It was negative. And I was very disappointed when I got my fecals back and it said negative for everything. But I'm going to put the caveat on that this cat was given amoxicillin clavulinate before that fecal sample was collected. So that may have given us a false negative on some of those. We started off with some fluids, potassium. We kept him warm. He needed quite a lot of analgesia. While you could consider kind of any of those, really, I think for his level of pain, I think methadone and then meropotent, it would be the way to go. To be honest, we used buprenorphine because it was before we had methadone. And meropotent, obviously, is a visceral analgesic. That's a great one to add in. If that hadn't been enough, then you could consider adding in gabapentin as well. We did ultrasound. His pancreas, you saw a picture of his pancreas earlier, it's horrible. So his parenchyma for his liver looked okay, but his pancreas, really didn't look pretty, really looked like a very active pancreatitis. You can see that we've got peripancreatic fat necrosis, look how white it is around here, and we've got a dilated pancreatic duct. All the signs very much fitted that this is a pancreatitis. And then because of the pancreatic pain and local peritonitis, we have got ileus of both the small and the large bowel, which is not surprising. These are his radiographs. Interesting, hey? Because what we've got is kind of an interstitial pattern in the lung fields. Now, think for a second, what could be causing those? Well, look at his blood vessels. This cat's got raging vasculitis. And what we know pancreatitis regularly causes is vasculitis. And when those blood vessels that are affected are blood vessels within the lungs and the pleura, you can get either pulmonary edema or pleural fluid. And he's got some degree of early interstitial inflammation related to that. What I think is quite stunning is the ileus of his large bowel. Does this mean I think he's got large bowel disease? Well, he might. He's certainly got green diarrhea and vomiting. So it could be his whole gut is affected. But I wonder whether or not some of this ileus is because the large bowel, the transverse colon, lies directly against the pancreas, as does the duodenum. And they were the most badly affected. So I'm pretty certain we have got pancreatitis, just from the tests we've done so far. I know we've got gut disease, and maybe we've got some degree of liver involvement as well. Unfortunately, with the clotting times and everything, I'm not happy to go get a liver biopsy. We could do some other tests. We've got some more blood. And yet his TLI and FPLI were both through the roof. And so that fits. His pancreas is screamingly unhappy and consistent. The B12 has gone down. So that could also be gut. And right enough, folate is low as well. So, you know, he desperately needs some B12, that's for sure. We could have done blood cultures to try and find out what presumed bacteria was causing this. But look at the state of his veins. And I've already taken quite a lot of blood. We could have done percutaneous FNA of the liver, the pancreas, mesenteric lymph nodes to get cytology and culture. But I was really worried about sticking too many needles in this cat because if I caused bleeding, I wasn't going to be able to stop it. And for the same reason, nobody was willing to countenance an explant. So we had to work with what we'd got. First thing is feeding. We opted for nasal feeding initially, so a nasal esophageal tube. That is because although cats don't like them, I really wasn't happy with a short anaesthetic to fit an O-tube in this cat because of the risk of bleeding, and I just wasn't happy with that. What we have done with similar cases, this little cat called Misty, and this little cat had acute salmonellosis, and the albumin got so low, we had to go for parenteral feeding. And what we've got here, we've got a combination. This line into her back leg is nutrition going straight into her vein. And then the belly wrap is because we've put a endoscopically placed feeding tube into her stomach. But then we've put through that one, we're actually feeding down past her stomach, down beyond her pancreas, down into her duodenum. So we've got duodenal, jejunal feeding, and enteral feeding, or parenteral feeding rather. So she was a particularly complicated case. Thankfully, Casper's albumin wasn't too bad, and his gut tolerated initially microenteral feeding, so just a very small amount of liquid feeding through a nasal tube, and then slowly we got him back to normal food. Obviously, he needed an antiemetic because he's vomiting badly, so metoclopramide, CRI, and meropenem, which also acted as his additional painkiller. Prokinetic, because we've got all this ileus, making sure that his fluids had potassium, because if the potassium is too low, that's going to make the ileus worse. An antacid, so omeprazole, twice daily, or vonoprazole, so we can go IV. And antibiotics, we were very worried that little Casper was going septic. So, you know, he's not there yet, but we're worried he was getting that. So we put him on IV clindamycin and amoxicillin clavulanate. We also added in antioxidants. So we had SAMI with a vitamin E combination. So it's a Paracil that we used. It's also got silibin in it. And then we supplemented his B12, folate, etc. So the big question, how did he do? It's a pretty intense case. Okay, not as intense as little Misty Mool in the corner there, but how did he do? He did brilliantly. And I think it is because he was a songbird fever. I think this was Salmonella typhimurium. I see it pretty regularly, typically in cats that hunt, and it's songbirds that they get it from. And interestingly, 50% of them present with no GI signs initially. They present as acute abdomens, sometimes with fever, sometimes without fever. They always seem to break with horrible green diarrhea and vomiting after about 3 days or so. Whereas, of course, Casper presented to us with the nasty green vomiting and diarrhea. So hopefully that gives you some useful tips about how to treat these cases. They are pretty complicated, and if you don't get on top of them, so certainly you'd have to warn Casper's people that he may be left with a chronic grumbling pancreatitis, which may cause him long-term problems. So that would be something to consider. So finished with another picture of my beautiful little girl, as she was in her old age. I'm very happy to take any questions that have been put through.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Danielle for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.